Book of Daniel. I'll just give you a little bit of an introduction on some of the big picture themes at the start and some things that have helped me get to my a little bit more knowledge around the Book of Daniel, and then hopefully that will help us in our own studies as we go through. I've come across a website called The Bible Project, and maybe people have come across it before. It's not Christadelphian, but it does give you a little bit of a feeling in some sort of animation, as well as just summarised form around the books of the Bible and some themes of the Bible. Again, it's not Christadelphian, so you've got to sort of look at it in some respects with the Bible at your right hand, as we used to say. But it's a really good summary on some of the topics, and Daniel is a good one here. And this is just a little summary on part of the book of Daniel, being Daniel chapter 1. But, you know, it'll be a picture which it's drawn in front of you, and so it's quite memorable. Pressure to give up Jewish identity, which then goes through to following the faithfulness to the Torah, leads to exaltation. And then it goes through another couple of different slides around Daniel chapter 1, and then leading into Daniel chapter 2 about the attack on Jerusalem and some prophecies that get fulfilled, and then the various people, the main people that are involved. So I thought I'd just give you a little bit of an intro to that, because it helped me in the book of Daniel just to get a picture in it. Like, I'm quite a visual person, and that can help just paint the picture, but then come back and put the detail in. So have a look at that and come and chat to me if you need any assistance on getting onto that website. One of the things, and it comes out really strongly in Daniel chapter 1, and I really want to make sure that this is quite a practical study for all of us. I want us to go away from the study of Daniel, particularly tonight, but the study of Daniel itself, and just understand that God is in control. And I want to make sure that not only do we have this concept that God's in control back in the Bible times, but God is in control right now. So God's in control of our lives. God's in control of what we're being exposed to, what trials might come upon us, what good times happen to us. And I think sometimes we might call upon God more in the times which aren't so good, as opposed to being thankful for times that are good. And I want to just emphasise that throughout tonight, because I see through the book of Daniel that God is certainly in control. If you had a look at the history books around this time, or if you talk to people in Babylon, you would have got a very different answer. No one would have said, oh, God was in control, and we'll see that in a second. And I run the risk, actually, of introducing the book of Daniel, stamping on other people's toes down the track. However, if I do, you'll have to just correct me when it's your turn, brethren who are involved. But the first thing that I just want to turn up is Daniel chapter 4 and verse 17. Because to me, this is one of the things that the book of Daniel is all about. And if we put it out there up front, then hopefully that'll be pretty clear, a bit of a theme as we go through. So God is in control. Daniel chapter 4 and verse 17, and this is an interpretation that Daniel's giving about a dream. And there's some discussions here, and Daniel says in verse 17, this matter is by the decree of the watchers and the demand by the word of the holy ones, to the intent that the living may know that the Most High rules in the kingdom of men and gives it to whomsoever he will and sets up over it the basest of men. So God chooses who's going to be in control at any particular time. And Daniel saw that. Nebuchadnezzar, I think, eventually saw it. He saw it in one part and then he forgot it, and then he saw it very quickly again, that God was in control. And there's another reference to this if you just want to jot down against that one, is Daniel chapter 5 verse 21, which is basically recounting that when Daniel was retelling that story, he actually refers back to that Daniel chapter 4 and verse 17. But I'll just give you an example here, because it is a little bit of a theme through the book of Daniel. But Daniel chapter 1, if we just turn back, and thanks, Tim, for reading that tonight. It's amazing if someone actually reads the chapter to you as opposed to you reading it. You pick up other things. So I should have got you to read it a week or so ago, Tim. But it was really good just to sit back and have that picture read. I mean, a lot of it we know, and it's just a matter of going back through and picking out some of the things that we maybe haven't seen recently. But we see there that Nebuchadnezzar, the king of Babylon, besieges Jerusalem. So that's what the history books will write down. They'll write down that Nebuchadnezzar came in and his army comes in and actually just defeats the opposition, and then in verse 2 drags away all the people into Babylon. But in fact, if you read carefully, which is what we're trying to do each time we open God's word, is the first section of verse 2, this is actually what happened. It wasn't Nebuchadnezzar at all. He was there. It could have been anyone. But it was actually God in control and giving Jehoiakim, the king of Judah, into Nebuchadnezzar's hand. And I want to just make sure that we're aware of that up front. That this book of Daniel that we're going to look through over the next couple of months shows God is in control in a number of different ways. And we'll pick up on some of them, but then we'll leave some of the gems for brethren coming along. The nations are subject to God's will. It's not the nations determining what they want to do and things just, you know, by chance happening. And the other thing that is a thread that comes through is that God is preserving his people throughout that time. Depending on doesn't matter what's happening, doesn't matter which country that they happen to be living in, they're going to be preserved. And I think that's something that we just need to bear in mind up front and as well as we go through our studies here. There's one thing that I like to do is a bit of audience participation, which I say never goes down well, but then Enfield just surprises me every time. Okay, good. So Daniel is a book of prophecy, but in fact, there was a prophecy that prophesied Daniel himself. Does anyone know where that is? Has anyone got it written down in their margin or know it off the top of their head? So this is actually a book, a prophetical book, but before it was actually happening, or before it was written down, someone actually wrote about it. Does anyone know? Some people are just looking down because they're studying so well. Isaiah 38. That is good. I'll say that's an excellent one. It's not the one I've got on the screen, so we'll give that 75%. But Isaiah 38, good. Everyone could write down Isaiah 38 in their margin as well. There are a couple. Can I say it's in Kings somewhere? Does that help anyone get the right answer? Huh? Second of Kings? I can't see who's actually talking here. Is it the tennis? Cam? Hey, he must be in a good Sunday school class. Second Kings chapter 20 and verse 18. Good. So if everyone just wants to turn up that, because this is a really good reference here, that we can just put in our margins, but also know that this is something that helps prove the Bible true. And I'm always on the lookout for things that will help us gain confidence in the Bible. And this is one chapter here, which it's Hezekiah's really sick. He's has a prophecy which actually Isaiah comes in, is verse 14. We'll get to the answer in verse 18, but Isaiah the prophet comes to King Hezekiah and says to him, "What said these men?" Hezekiah, you might know the background, he shows them all of the precious things, the silver and gold out of the house, which wasn't a good thing to do. Isaiah comes in and says, "What did you do?" And so Hezekiah said, well, verse 15, all the things that are in mine house they've seen, there is nothing among my treasures that I've not shown them. And Isaiah says to Hezekiah, "Hear the word of the Lord." And here's a prophecy. "Behold, the days come that all that is in thy house and all which thy fathers have laid up in store unto this day shall be carried into Babylon. Nothing shall be left, saith Yahweh. And of thy sons," this is Cam's verse, "of thy sons that shall issue from thee," so this is from Hezekiah, from the kingly seed, "which thou shalt beget, shall they take away, and they shall be eunuchs in the palace of the king of Babylon." And if you've got a Bible similar to mine, in the margin here, The number 2 in verse 18, the squiggly line, because I've drawn it in there, says, fulfilled Daniel chapter 1 and verse 3. So if you haven't got that already highlighted or written in, it's probably a worthwhile thing to write in there. And there's a few others. Isaiah, as Brother Bailey said, Isaiah, and then also 2 Kings 20, and then Isaiah. I've got Isaiah 39 as well, which is, again, Isaiah's recollection of this discussion that he had with Hezekiah. So that's a good thing just to start off with, just saying that this book's actually a prophecy, but it was actually prophesied in advance. So something just to stamp it that God's got the approval here in this this prophecy. Now, a couple of things which I just wanted to put up front, and then we'll refer to a little bit throughout, and also they'll be picked up throughout the book as well. A couple of themes. I've already said God is in control, so we'll have a look at that in a little bit more detail. The real God versus fake, and I won't say fake gods because it was other leaders as well that stood up that lasted for a bit that would have seemed really real if you were there, and it did because a lot of people went along with it, but they turned out to be not so real. And then also standing for God and living your life for Him. So that's something that I think we can look at as we go through tonight and then as we go through the studies of Daniel. So just on that first one there, God is in control. We've seen it there in verse 2 of Daniel chapter 1. The Lord gave Jehoiakim, king of Judah, into his hand. We've also got a couple of other references throughout this chapter, which I've just coloured in because it helps stand out. And this is just in chapter 1. We'll look out for it in other chapters going forward. But you might remember, as Tim read at verse 8, Daniel purposes in his heart that he's not going to defile himself. And then what happens? He gets a lot of friends. Daniel gets a lot of friends, and his friends are very popular. Well, yes, but what actually happened was verse 9. Now, God had brought Daniel into favour. So there's a blessing that Daniel's got, but Daniel's saying, actually, God brought me into favour as opposed to me doing it myself. And then once the test was over, and we'll have a look at this in a bit more detail, but look at the end of the chapter, verse 17. And as for these four children, Daniel and his three friends, God gave them knowledge and skill. Now, no doubt, Daniel would have spent time looking through the books and trying to remember things as per his training. But Daniel summarises at the end here, as for these children, God gave them knowledge and skill in all learning and wisdom. And then, and Daniel had understanding. Well, in the margin, it actually says, and he made Daniel understand. So just in this chapter here, we've got four references to God directing Daniel's life or directing things around Daniel to give him some benefits or some blessings that otherwise you probably would have looked at and said, oh, yep, that's Daniel is really smart, really handsome. Well, that happens to smart, handsome people, right? So, but no, God had brought Daniel into favour and tender love with the prince of the eunuchs. And I think I've mentioned it before, but I think that's one thing that maybe we can actually do. We can stop and look at our lives and see how God's actually working in our lives a bit more, rather than, oh, that's because we put our effort in. I think we need to be able to stop and thank God for what's happening in our lives, both blessings as well as opportunities to learn through our life. So we can see our God's hand in our life, as well as our ecclesia's life, as well as our country's life, as well as the earth, where, with all of the nations around, you can see God's hand so clearly. So it's worthwhile just stopping and thinking, like Daniel has here, yep, God's actually brought me into favour, or God's given us knowledge. I won't spend a long time on this, but the first six chapters of Daniel really portray this difference between, and the contrast, I guess, between the real God and various fakes that turn up. Either the gods of Nebuchadnezzar or the gods of Babylon in general, the Chaldeans, or other people who thought they were in place of God. So Just very quickly, we see that in verse 2 of chapter 1. The Lord gives Jehoiakim, king of Judah, into his hand with parts of the vessels of the house of God. So we're pulling them out of the house of God, which he then carries into the land of Shinar to the house of his God. So we're putting the house of God in Judah up against the house of Nebuchadnezzar's God. And then there's a treasure house of his God. And then it goes on to Daniel and his three friends were supposed to learn or be taught the learning and tongue of the Chaldeans. And that was the whole focus. But that actually really didn't work because in the end, verse 17, the real God gave them knowledge and skill in all learning. And not just gave them some. It wasn't just, oh, yeah, well, I think they're better. They did a test. They got a little bit better. They were 10 times better. There was no doubt God was involved in their improvement there. Chapter 2, I might just quickly skip over this. We've got Nebuchadnezzar's wise men versus God's wise man. And what's the conclusion? Have a look at verse 47 of Daniel chapter 2. The king, Nebuchadnezzar, actually gets to this point. And he says in verse 47 of chapter 2, of a truth it is. And this would have been pretty hard for Nebuchadnezzar to say, although he did relapse in chapter 3, but he says, of a truth it is that your God is a God of gods and a Lord of kings and a revealer of secrets, seeing that thou couldest reveal this secret. So he's putting the real God at the level that he should be. So interesting how it starts off that there is, you know, some wise men. He's putting a whole lot of faith in that, but then in that group. But then by the end, he says, actually, I've change. I can see that actually the real God is beneficial in these times. And then chapter 3, as I say, relapses, and we've now got Nebuchadnezzar going, actually, no, it's not a whole image of different metals. It's all me. It's all I'm the head and all the body, and I'm going to last forever. There's going to be no change of kingdoms. But then what happens at the end of that chapter, verse 28, Nebuchadnezzar speaks again and says, blessed be the real God, the God of Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, who has sent his angel, delivered his servants that trusted him, have changed the king's word, yielded their bodies, that they might not serve nor worship any god except their own God. And then makes a decree, actually, and says, well, you know what I said at the start? I'm changing that. I'm going to actually make a decree that we need to focus on the real God. Chapter 4, chapter 5, chapter 6 is very similar in the themes there. Nebuchadnezzar goes out and he's now an animal. Towards the end of the chapter, he then turns around and says, actually, no, I realise the Most High in verse 34, I praise and honour him that lives forever. His dominion's an everlasting dominion. So he goes from me, my gods, to the real God. Nebuchadnezzar's son in chapter 5 does a similar thing. He's trusting in his own self. He thinks he can take advantage of all the good things that they brought out of Judah, but that doesn't end well at the end when in that night, verse 30, Belshazzar, the king of the Chaldeans, was slain. That's not said lightly. This is everything that Belshazzar stands for is not going to be stood up to, because in the end, verse 21, which referred to before, the Most High God rules in the kingdom of men. So there's a reference there that Daniel is reminding Belshazzar that this is the real God as opposed to all those other gods that Belshazzar might be holding to. And then chapter 6, Daniel in the lion's den, when he looks like he's around about 85 to 90 years of age. There's a story of this whole story here is around the law of God versus the law of the Medes and Persians. And the end of chapter 6, that's where Darius comes and writes another law and says, everyone needs to fear and tremble before the God of Daniel in verse 26. Because, and we need to understand this, we need to think about this all the time, for he is a living God and steadfast forever. His kingdom, that which shall not be destroyed, and his dominion shall be even unto the end. So that's just a quick snapshot. There's a couple of other references which we can have a look at, chat about later if we want to. So The other thing that I've got just here, other theme I've got here is standing for God. And I think that's, again, another thing that I think we can focus on a little bit more through our studies, but also in our own lives. And Daniel chapter 1 is a good reference point for that, because this is the whole point of Daniel. If you have a look in verse 4, we've got a reference here to all the children that came out. They listed out a whole list of good characteristics, external but also internal, with their knowledge and good looks, and that as such as had ability in them to stand in the king's palace. And that was all, one of the things that the Nebuchadnezzar wanted them to do is stand in the palace. He wanted them to be there and then be essentially his spokespeople, his wise men, and that was the big focus of this couple of years of learning. And then again in verse 5, the king appoints them the meat and the drink, nourishing them 3 years, that at the end, the answer is that they might stand before the king. Well, we all know the answer towards the end of this chapter. There is Daniel and his three friends pass with flying colours. Verse 19, the king communes with them, and among them all was found none like Daniel and his three friends. Therefore stood they before the king. But that's just in his life while he's learning and in the court of the king. But what about the rest? He, all the way through the book of Daniel, and I'll leave that up to the other presenters, but I did want to just turn right to the last verse of Daniel, because this is what Daniel was actually aiming towards. This was his life. He was learning things. He was good looking. He was very smart. But this, well, that wasn't important for Daniel. And you can see the end result, the conclusion of Daniel's life in Daniel chapter 12. So Daniel chapter 12, the man clothed in linen says to Daniel, "Go your way. After all of this is finished, go your way till the end be, for thou shalt rest." It's quite a long rest, 2,500 years rest, until the next sentence is going to be, and "for thou shalt rest and stand in thy lot at the end of the days." So we've got Daniel preparing to stand before King Nebuchadnezzar and in the courts, but ultimately it was Daniel's end result. The conclusion of his whole life was he was going to rest. He'd done a good job. And there's nothing negative written about Daniel all the way through the book of Daniel. It's quite amazing. And he's going to have that rest, 2,500 years, and then stand in his lot at the end of the day. So there is a lot there for Daniel. He's succeeded. He's done what he's required to do, and there is a lot there that he will stand in at the last day. So I thought that was just a bit of a fly-through of a few themes that we will cover off through tonight, as well as the rest of the studies. And I thought I might just pop back and then just do a bit of a intro to whereabouts the book is set, time frames, and a few things, just so we can get a bit of a handle on it, just for some people that may not have looked at it before. So I'll start off with where did it happen, and I don't know if we can actually see that there, but we know the map of the Middle East reasonably well. We've got Judah over here and Babylon over here. And there's two ways that you can get there. You can either go straight there, or you can go up and then back down again. Now, it would be tempting for someone to go straight across. But does anyone know why you wouldn't do that? Oh, we're at school. No water. Fantastic. So there's a big desert, as you can probably see. That colour, yellow, indicates desert. No water. Right. So this was the issue, and they didn't have Google Maps back then. However, if you do drive from around Jerusalem across to where Babylon, we think, you know, the main capital of Babylon was, compared to some of the Google Maps places now, it's around about 1,200 kilometres. So I think, you know, 15 kilometres a day is my guess, because probably loaded up, everyone's sort of not really keen to be walking through there, and I've guessed around about 80 days. So this is Daniel and his three friends. If they went on the expressway with no water, 80 days. But if you go up and over, it's around about 2,000 kilometres up through, and in theory, there is more water here because there's a river down here. Okay, so that's the way that they'd probably go. And if you go up and about, it's 2,000 kilometres, which is probably going to be, you know, almost double as around about 130 days, 135 days, depending if you've got a tailwind. But you're probably, you know, on the road for 5 months. All right? 5 months of walking, and this is Daniel. Okay? So Daniel is with his three friends and all the rest of them, and they're walking for this long. They've been taken out of their country probably around about 15, 16, 17, depending what you read, but, you know, mid-teens to around 17. And they would have been, yeah, headed off there, left pretty much everything behind, and they would have been looked after, most probably, because they would have been seen that they were in that group, that cream of the crop. But we'll get to that in a second. So up and over, and they'll get there at some stage. Now, I was going to do some discussion here, but I think we'll just scoot through and we'll just get rid of Where's Wally, because we just want to go straight onto here. I started to put together my own little timeline, and then I was looking in my Bible and I thought, actually, this is a pretty good timeline. I'll just use this one. So, has everyone got one of these? If you haven't, it's really cool, because it just lists out everything. So, about 950 BC coming through to 700-ish, and we're around about, so I've just put it on here, there's Daniel just there. Can everyone see that in the middle there? Yep. So that's Daniel there. And what I found was quite fascinating is if you just actually spend, you know, 10, 15 minutes looking at Daniel and who was working alongside of him or living at the same time, it puts it into context, a couple of the things that were written about him and in other prophecies as well. So some of the things that we'll come across during our studies, actually very interesting to see. And one of the things that probably is interesting is that Daniel, if he was here at 605-ish, and he's about 15, if we go back, 15 to 20, somewhere in there, if we go back, it would be around about 620 or 625 when he was born. And it messed with my head. I love numbers, but I was going backwards because it's negative. See, I can see some strange faces. Not just because that's what you look like. That's just trying to do the calculation I was doing. So 620, 625, he would have been in and around here. And can you see one of the people that he would have probably known or seen? Josiah. Yeah? So King Josiah, and everyone knows what King Josiah did. And it would have been, if I just sort of did the numbers, Josiah probably found the book of the law in the 18th year of his reign, around about when Daniel was maybe, I did a quick calculation, around 5 or 6 years of age. And at 5 and 6, for those next couple of years, that was a pretty exciting time to be in the land of Israel. When they found the law and all the law was back reinstituted, that was a very important and exciting part of the time. And I, based on the understanding of Daniel and how he reacts in a couple of the circumstances, I think that he was probably brought up in quite a well-to-do home. He was part of the king's seed, children of Israel, the king's seed and of the princes, reasonably well-educated in the things of the truth as well as outside. And all the way through this book, we see Daniel and his three friends wanting to carry out the principles of God, not just get the best out of this world. So I emphasise that for families, young families, bringing up their children. It's a really good thing to be focused on the principles of God. And we know that, but it's very good to be reminded of that as well. So that was one thing that I thought it was very interesting just to see. And I did a bit of a zoom in on this as well, just so you could actually see a couple of the things here. So Daniel, and then having, so basically 605, 606 was his, and then around about that 70 years, which is that 70-year prophecy, when the temple started to be rebuilt at 536. So anyway, that chops out a bit of the detail, but it does give you some of the information. Now, So we're imagining now Daniel walking across, so probably 2,000 kilometres, probably 135 days, 5 months, walking through hot circumstances. It didn't matter probably if it was summer, autumn or winter, it was just hot. So here he is approaching the place of Babylon. But it doesn't actually say Babylon here. Did you see that in verse 2? Because Jehoiakim was given into Nebuchadnezzar with all the vessels that carries it across into the land of Shinar. Now, there's no references to Shinar going back in the Old Testament except back to Genesis chapter 10. And I'll just put this little slide up here, and I encourage everyone just to do a little mini study on Shinar, because it's actually really interesting how that actually stands together in the book, in the earlier books of the Bible, particularly Genesis. And it's a name for Babylon, but it's, if I can summarise it really quickly, it's the land of Nimrod, a land of rebellion. And so here was Daniel coming out of Jerusalem, the city of peace, God's chosen place, into the land of rebellion. And this is one thing that Daniel would have, it would have struck Daniel, because here is someone who wants to stand up for the principles of God, and he's now going into this land of rebellion. And it would have been pretty tricky for Daniel and his three friends to actually step past what they could see. And I'll just list out a few things that Babylon would have looked like at the time, because we've got a lot of archaeology that helps us understand that. We're told Babylon, the greatest city of the day, approximately 70 kilometres around a circumference. The walls were about 65 metres high, approximately 15 metres deep, and they went down into the ground as well so that they couldn't be burrowed under. 250 towers on the walls, 100 gates of brass. There was a moat surrounding the city, so that made it even harder to get into. So basically impregnable, or so they thought. Through the middle of the city was the Euphrates River. We all heard of the famous Hanging Gardens of Babylon. That was one of the seven wonders of the world, or is. And I'm told that the city was made of bricks stamped with the name of Nebuchadnezzar in them. So they've pulled up this city and they can see Nebuchadnezzar's name everywhere. So this is Daniel and his three friends turning up to this, what looks like a pretty permanent place. So this is a really big test for Daniel and his three friends. There's a summary of a few things in verse 3 and verse 4 of who these people were. And they were, as a number of study guides that I've looked at, they call them the cream of the crop. They were the best. Okay, I read through this list and I thought, actually, some of those apply to me, but I'll let you work that out. Well, that's what my Sunday school class says anyway. So then they had to go through 3 years of training, and there was something at the end that they needed to pass, and there was a test, and we'll have a look at that in a second. The whole point in verse 4 was that they might stand in the king's palace. So they're basically courtiers, so a male court official. They had to stand there, be conversant in the learning and tongue of the Chaldeans. So this was going to get drilled into these young men. Daniel was very clever, and that would have been a strength, but also a weakness in this situation, where he didn't want to mingle with these people too much, but he needed to get along, I guess, occupy whilst he was in that spot. Just put up another little summary here, because there's other references throughout here where, you know, Babylon, when the traditions of Babylon have been reviewed, they connect really good-looking people with really smart people. So Daniel had both of those, and that would have helped him stand in good stead in the Babylonian realm there. We then go through a couple of things in here, which is, again, a pressure on Daniel and his three friends. The next thing that happens is that instead of having the names that they were given when they were born by their parents, the parents thought about their names, they actually were told, nope, you're not going to have that name anymore. And I'll just put them up here and then explain a few things around this, because I didn't actually realise it, and I've read Daniel a few times, and I've probably slept through a couple of Daniel studies as well. But each of the names of Daniel and his three friends actually have the name of God inside of their names. So their parents have said, I want to call you by this name, Daniel, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah. So you've got the name of God, Ael or Yah, throughout each of these names. Now, I don't know if I was told that a few times and I just didn't listen, but I'm telling everyone here, so hopefully you don't go through till 43 years of age or whatever I am, without really understanding it. So here is a situation where these three friends of Daniel and three friends have got a reference to God in their name. And then the prince of the eunuchs then says, actually, no, part of our training is to move you from over there in Israel across to over here in Babylon, and we want to start by actually referring to you using the names of the Babylonian gods. I'll just skip through this here. And funnily enough, each of the names that they were then given had references to the Babylonian gods. So there's no reference now to Daniel, it's Belteshazzar. Hananiah, it's now Shadrach, and etc. One of the ones that I thought was interesting is that Mishael here is almost identical in the the Mishael's name versus Meshach, the two different cultures. It was the first syllables retained, but then they've just taken off the God, the reference to God off the end, and put the reference to Shak, which is a Babylonian name of a goddess in Babylon. So it wasn't, they weren't trying to be sneaky about it. They just said, right, you're not referencing to the God of Israel anymore. You're now referencing to the gods in Babylon. So it was pretty obvious what was going on here. So here was Daniel and his three friends that were trained up in the ways of God, and now they're being pressured into the ways of Babylon. Interesting, going from here, the reference, there is no reference to Daniel using this new name, except that it says Daniel, whom Nebuchadnezzar called Belteshazzar. So Daniel had nothing. If someone said, hey, Belteshazzar, he just would have kept walking. Right? So he had nothing to do with the gods of the Babylonians. It's very, very big pressure for these three friends and for Daniel when they're in the land of Babylon. So we needed to make sure, if you were part of that group, that you would be able to stand up for something. And similar stories in the Old Testament, earlier on in the Old Testament, of Moses and Joseph. And you can go through and do a bit of a comparison between these very similar stories of young men, very faithful backgrounds and upbringings, taken away from their families and having to survive in quite an ungodly world, both Moses and Joseph. And it's really interesting to have a look through that, comparison throughout. So we get through to this point here, and probably the most important word in this chapter is this word here, but, because it changes the theme. Here we've got the start of the chapter is trying to force these three friends and Daniel into a certain way, and then Daniel says, actually, no, there is something that I'm actually going to make a stand on. And you can see there in verse 8, Daniel purposes in his heart. And this word purpose, for what words are meaning, it's actually the same word in verse 7, the prince of the eunuchs gave names. He was determined to change their name from the Israelitish name to the Babylonian name. Well, Daniel says, actually, you're determined to do that. Well, actually, I'm determined not. And so then verse 8, Daniel purposes in his heart, he actually stands up and says, actually, nope, I'm making a promise. I'm making a covenant now to not defile myself with the king's meat nor the wine which he drank. A couple of reasons pop up. There's nothing written here. necessarily. Some people say, well, maybe he was going to go vegetarian or teetotaler. He doesn't want to drink anymore. I don't think that's right, because later on in the book he does have meat and wine. So I don't think that's quite what it's talking about there. Some people might think that, but we can have a chat about it afterwards. A couple of reasons. Maybe there was unclean animals in there, in the mix, and Daniel wasn't sure what was happening there. He was still trying to stand up for the things of God, and so that was the easiest way to not do that. Maybe they were okay animals, but maybe they weren't killed according to the law of Moses. So he wasn't in control of that, so I'm going to stand up for that. Probably, which is what I've always thought, is that the animals were probably offered up to the gods of Babylon. Now, our readings, I think it was last night or the night before, said idols of this world are nothing. Now, Daniel would have known that, but it's hard to show that if you're chowing down on something that's just come straight off the hot plate of, Bel Merodach or something. Yeah. One of the gods that they offered. And it's really hard to show that you're separate if you're right in the mix of that. So maybe that's why Daniel is saying that he doesn't want to have those servings of meat and drink. And therefore, he then asks the prince of the eunuchs that he might not defile himself. So Nebuchadnezzar's trying to change them, trying to educate them, trying to change their names, and trying to change their food and drink. But Daniel says, actually, no, this is something that I'm going to stand for. And as I say as I said at the start, we've got to have something to stand for. There's a saying that says if you don't stand for anything, you'll fall for everything. And that's, I think, is important. One of the things that Daniel shows here, I think, is that Daniel's standing up for what he thinks is right, and it's something that he can then, maybe it's a conversation starter as well. Well, I'm not having that because I'm actually involved in the things of the real God, and that would come out over time. Two quotes that I just wanted to mention here. Maybe you just write down Acts 11:23, because it's a similar idea there, where Barnabas says, with the purpose of heart, they should cleave to the Lord. There was really intense belief in what they were living, and they had a purpose of heart, and it just shows that you can't just drift into the kingdom. It's not like there's not a tide going towards the kingdom and you just sort of end up there and go, oh wow, here I am. You've actually got to really, really try and drive towards the kingdom. But I did want to just turn to Deuteronomy 32, because I think that's something which I read, and I thought, yeah, actually this is really good, and it narrows it right down for us as well. Deuteronomy 32, and it works in a whole lot of different circumstances as well, but this, particularly in this circumstance, I thought it was quite relevant. And this is right at the end of Moses' life, and Moses says, verse 46, set your hearts unto all the words which I testify among you this day, which ye shall command your children to observe to do. Sorry, Deuteronomy 32, verse 47. For it is not a vain thing for you. It's not a waste of time. So what I've told you over the last couple of chapters, it's not a waste of time. It's not a vain thing for you, because it is your life. So it's like, it's not like you'll get a slightly higher pay rise or you get a slightly better car. It is actually your life. It's really, really important. And through this thing, you shall prolong your days in the land. You'll get blessings. But the focus for Moses was set your hearts unto all these words and make sure that you are going to be really focused on this, because it's actually really important. It is actually your life. So I thought that was good. And then Acts 11, verse 23 is a good one just to put alongside of it as well. So back to Daniel 1, and we'll just scoot through the last couple of bits here. So we've got a couple of things that God brings to Daniel. It's favour and tender love with the prince of the eunuchs. We've got kindness and compassion, other renderings of favour and tender love. Daniel was no doubt really intelligent and diligent, but there was something else here. God was bringing Daniel into this kindness and compassion or favour and tenderness here, tender love. And I think if we try our best, we purpose in our heart, and God does bring things into our life, then we need to be able to turn around and say, actually, yes, God's done that in our life as well. And I think that's worthwhile not forgetting. He's never going to leave us or forsake us, even though there might be trials. And when there's trials and or blessings, I think we can reference back to God. And one thing, I should have got you actually to stop at Proverbs 16, but if you write down, well, there's a couple of quotes there we can reference, but Proverbs 16 verse 17 just says, when a man's ways please Yahweh, he makes even his enemies to be at peace with him. And I think that's really appropriate here for Daniel, because he's right in the midst of Shinar, the enemy's tooth. He's in Babylon, and this is going to be the test for him. And when he's pleasing Yahweh, as he is, then even his enemies are at peace with him. And we can see similar references I've got there. We've referenced before around back to Joseph and having the favour and tender love that was shown to him as well. The prince of the eunuchs here was quite scared because it says, I fear my lord the king in verse 10. And we don't know much before verse 10 about Nebuchadnezzar and the way that he reacted, but we certainly know afterwards how excited Nebuchadnezzar would get when things didn't go quite his way. Halfway through chapter 2, chapter 3, when he just loses everything. He just is in a rage. And so this must have happened before, and the prince of the eunuchs says, actually, I'm really scared for myself. And then Daniel talks to Melzar in verse 11 and says, give us 10 days. And Daniel is having faith that this is going to go the way that he wants it to go. He doesn't want to touch the king's meat or the king's drink, and he has faith. He doesn't say there that God's going to do anything. Doesn't say that. Later on, the three friends do. They say, well, we're putting our trust in God. If it does go that way, good. If it doesn't, well, we're still not going to bow down. And I think Daniel's frame of mind here is exactly the same. He says, I'm going to do what I think is right before God. Doesn't matter what the end result is. So verse 15 then. Verse 15, we get the end result here. End of 10 days, the countenance appeared fairer and fatter in flesh than all the children. All the children which did eat the portion of the king's meat. And it's not just they sat inside and ate chocolate to become fairer and fatter. I'm sure some people in the audience would want to do that. But having this test that they've put to there, God's blessed them to say, actually, we're going to give these children, these, as it says there in verse 17, we're going to give these four children this appearance of fair, being more fair and fatter in flesh, so we're healthier. As well as it goes on to say in verse 17, that God gives them knowledge and skill in all learning and wisdom. So it's God's skill. Okay, God gives them this knowledge and skill. And then Daniel goes on to use that in the next period of his life as he's trying to then stand up for God, but also be able to assist the nation of Babylon when Nebuchadnezzar needs it. Nebuchadnezzar was something was quite a hard taskmaster. He's quite a tough boss. But look at verse 19. The king communes with them. Here he is coming to do his own little test. So there was obvious that in verse 15 that it happened after 10 days. But then it says at the end of the days that the king said should be brought in. So you'd assume it's the 3 years that they were talking about that they'd be nourished. So at the end of the 3 years, the king comes in. And he starts doing his own test. He's communing with them, just gently. He's finding out about the test that's happened and work out who's knowledgeable in all science and skillful in wisdom. Well, here he is. He says, and among them all was found none like Daniel, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah. Therefore stood they before the king. And verse 20 says, and all matters of wisdom and understanding, the king inquired of them. He found them 10 times better than everyone else, not just the ones that were in the palace, but everyone else that was in the realm. So I think that's a good stamp of approval of someone that has got God's knowledge and skill and all wisdom. And then I think just the last thing that is referenced here in Daniel chapter 1 is that Daniel continued even unto the first year of King Cyrus. And so here is the king. Nebuchadnezzar sets up in chapter 1 of Daniel saying, this is my realm. You're coming into my place here. We're taking you out of Israel and we're going to put you in here. And then Daniel just puts at the end of this chapter that I continued past Nebuchadnezzar. So Cyrus, in the first year of King Cyrus, he continued even further than that. But just to say at the end of this chapter, Nebuchadnezzar, you wanted me to do this. You wanted our friends to do this. Well, we didn't, and we continued on, and you didn't. So I think that's just a little footnote there to this chapter to make sure that we're actually reminded that it doesn't matter how real the world looks, it doesn't matter how permanent solid it looks, it's actually quite a fleeting thing. So a couple of other things that we can chat about afterwards, but I thought that probably just gives us a bit of an introduction to Daniel chapter 1 and looking at Daniel the person and his three friends as people, as opposed to just a story that we might have learnt over time. But